Hello and welcome to the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michaela, and today I have the pleasure to talk to Katie Mouzouris, the founder and CEO of Luta Security. But before I start, I wanted to introduce you to ComfyCat, who sponsors today's episode. ComfyCat is a young startup that revolutionizes feature flag management. I met with one of the founders 2 weeks ago, and he walked me through the main features of the tool. They are super enthusiastic about ensuring every company from small to large can release new features rapidly with less risk by using feature flags. ComfyCat lets you hide or expose features in your application without redeploying the code. What's really cool is that it's designed for both developers and product managers. Also, less tech-savvy people are up and running within 10 minutes of training. ComfyCat supports JavaScript, React, Python, Java, well, over 13 different languages and frameworks. I have seen how seamless and effortless it integrates and how powerful the configuration management behind your flags is. They offer an extremely generous free plan, and with each paid plan, they plant a tree. So, well, I can tell you I'm in love with this company and the product, so I really hope you check them out at comfycat.com. But now, back to Katie. Katie is the founder and CEO of a new security startup company called Luta Security. Luta Security specializes in helping businesses and governments work with hackers and security researchers to better defend themselves from digital attacks. Katie is also an expert when it comes to bug bounty programs and also how you successfully prepare organizations to implement one. So I'm super thrilled to have Katie here with me. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm also really, really thrilled. So, Katie, can you tell me and my listeners a little bit more about security vulnerability programs? What are those and why should we care?
Well, everybody has heard of, you know, security bugs. They cause a lot of hacks, a lot of breaches, a lot of losses, and, you know, cause a lot of problems. So why should we care? Well, it's because we run on a lot of software and hardware, and all software and hardware contains bugs because it is designed and implemented by human beings, and we are flawed. And so why should we care about vulnerabilities? Because we should really care about the safety and security and privacy of the world we live in.
Yeah. And so what are vulnerability disclosure programs in particular? So how can you, I imagine that? Is that I'm, you know, designing some processes so that others can report bugs, for example, that they find, or is that also something that happens internally?
Well, vulnerability disclosure is a term that is used to describe, you know, letting somebody know about a vulnerability. It was actually originated by the hacker side of the equation, security researchers, as, you know, some companies refuse to call them hackers, but I am a hacker, you know, and so the term itself was about how will hackers disclose vulnerabilities either to the public to let them know that they're not safe and what steps to protect themselves, or disclose the vulnerability to a software vendor, usually, you know, to tell them about it so that software vendor can fix it and then issue a patch or an advisory or something to tell its users what to do. But the term vulnerability disclosure actually originated with hackers. It then became adopted by organizations who want to create a process to receive vulnerability reports and then disclose, you know, the outcome, right, of their investigation, either nothing to see here, you know, this wasn't actually a bug, or an actual software patch or, you know, or fix and an advisory. So that is the process of vulnerability disclosure as we know it today.
And so I imagine I'm like a company, and obviously my software probably has some security, you know, holes, some vulnerabilities. And so if people are coming and hacking my site, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? So do I want people to come and find issues on my site, or do I want them to stay away?
Well, you definitely want a mechanism that if somebody notices something wrong with your site, you know, that you'd have some mechanism to receive a vulnerability report from the outside. But that should not happen before you've actually looked for vulnerabilities yourself. And mm-hmm. that is something that is hugely important and often overlooked when people look at vuln disclosure programs as sort of an end goal to their security, where once they do that, then they're all good and they'll just wait for the public to tell them about vulnerabilities. That's a very inefficient mindset. So yes, you should have a way for people to report vulnerabilities to you from the outside. But if that's your primary source of learning about vulnerabilities, then you are not a very secure organization and you have made very unwise choices and investments in what you've decided to do first.
Yeah, so, and if I'm, let's say I'm ordinary, maybe a little bit smaller company, maybe a young company, I don't know, you know, something like this. And we have developed software and, you know, this is what we mainly do. We think this is our business goal, right? And we want to go to market. And so our main resources are software engineers that are working on our system. What would be some of the first steps if we ourselves know that we haven't invested enough in security? What should be our first step to make our system more secure and, you know, detect and close our own vulnerabilities?
Well, I think that it's super important to incorporate the principles of a secure development lifecycle, meaning you're building security in at every stage, starting with the design phase and architecture phase, and then going into, as you start to implement the code yourself, doing static and dynamic analysis, doing code reviews, and making sure that you've left enough time to address any of those issues. I've seen organizations say, yes, we do a secure development lifecycle. Yes, we do, you know, static and dynamic analysis, pen testing, code reviews ourselves. But I see it so late in the process that there's really not enough time left by the organization to address any issues. And they just release the software anyway, knowing about serious bugs and just saying they're going to catch them in the next update or the next major release. And, you know, so I think that organizations thinking about this as what should we do as our first step? It's always invest internally to try and reduce the number and the severity of vulnerabilities that even cross your front door threshold. And then from there, you know, then set up, you know, a way to receive vulnerability reports for anything that you missed. But definitely don't leave it to the outside. That's according to NIST guidelines and documentation says that it's up to 45 times more costly to address vulnerabilities after software has been released, as opposed to finding those flaws as early as the design phase.
Yeah, that's really good. And so if you have like this software engineers, do we train them or do we hire, you know, specialists, security specialists? Do we outsource that? What would be, you know, your procedure here? Let's say we don't have really a lot of security experts now in our organization.
Well, most organizations don't have security experts, and that's a reality that we have to face as well. So I think that, you know, training them ideally is helpful. Creating software development environments that have tooling that supports more secure engineering practices. You know, there are things built into various SDEs that make it harder for you to make certain types of coding mistakes. I think that's important. But then I also think that it's important to bring in outside expertise. You are not going to have all of the internal folks knowing what, you know, a security expert of many years is going to know. So bringing in outside experts is super important at, you know, even before you've released the software and before you look for crowdsourced help in the form of vuln disclosure programs or bug bounty programs, you should actually be hiring professionals, professional pen testers, professional code reviewers, professional security architects and security architect reviewers. And if you can't afford to keep them year round as full-time employees, hiring them on a contract basis is absolutely essential before you go to market.
Yeah. So actually, one of the things that come to my mind is that very recently in one of the groups that I am in, some, you know, startup group and so on, there was a question about, you know, how to do a pen test and how to get pen testers. And I actually recommended your company there. And then they decided, no, we are doing it in-house. We will learn that, right? And so it's like one really not technical person and one engineer that writes the whole software system. And now they are also doing the pen tester. And I think most of the pen testing was actually done by the non-technical person, right? And when I heard about it, I was like, yeah, I don't know if this is really something I would advise, but what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I'm sure they probably uncovered some issues, and it was a great learning experience, you know, and certainly that will strengthen the ability for those internal people to not make those precise same mistakes again. But you can't exactly, you know, just throw an anatomy book into the woods and hope that surgeons come out, right? You know, you do need training and you do need expertise to get the most coverage. And I think that's the most dangerous part of the scenario that you described, is that they may feel like they did the best, you know, of their ability, but there's no guarantee there with non-experts sort of teaching themselves that they'd have the code coverage that they need to be more secure, the confidence that their architecture review really took into account true security threats, which over time, you know, as pen testers and reviewers, we know what these patterns are, you know, and everything, and it's not going to be like a brand new problem every time. So while I commend them for using this as an opportunity to broaden the skills of their internal folks, and that's definitely the right thing to do on that front, it's definitely not going to be as effective at securing your products than if you were to hire true experts to come in and do it for you.
Yeah. And so you were talking a little bit about code reviews. And well, when I was working at a larger organization, we had like code reviews, which were done by, you know, software engineers. And they were mainly about, you know, obviously also a little bit about security, but it wasn't the main focus. There was a lot about maintainability, readability of the code, right? Also, you know, is this even the right feature that we are building, right? So business aspects that we are having here. And then a lot of the code actually went through a security review, which was a very separate step. Is that something that you see that's very common? Is it something that you recommend, or should be security? Or if maybe, as I said, it's a larger organization, if we are not having those larger organizations, do we have the security aspects in our daily code reviews? Or should we, as a software engineering team, maybe set times aside and say, well, this is now a dedicated security review of a larger part of our organization?
Well, I've seen different models work best, because you are trying to balance, you know, getting that software out to market, what your internal resources are and what their skill sets are, and what budget you have to bring in external eyeballs who are experts. And I think there's a lot of balancing going on with that. But the scenario you described, you know, honestly, you know, I think that dedicated resources and dedicated steps devoted to security and security reviews are very, very important. And the sooner organizations build that type of, you know, dedicated security effort into their processes, they'll actually find that their code is more maintainable, that their code is more, you know, is more robust and efficient. Because, you know, it, as we know, a lot of the time, a security hole actually manifests as a crash, with unintended input causing a crash. That's a reliability issue. So if, you know, orgs are really focused on reliability when it comes to code reviews, it shouldn't be that much of a stretch to explain that if you dedicate specific time for security, you're not necessarily adding a lot of effort in one area that is disproportional. It actually informs and assists in the efforts that you were already doing for other reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you were talking about some of the software engineering practices. You were talking about static analysis, dynamic analysis, right? Having your IDE configured in a way, you know, that you cannot do some of the issues. Maybe there are also like parts during the code review that tell you, you know, something is wrong here. But you were also talking about the design phase already, right? So that we are starting really from the beginning, and that security is part of our considerations, even maybe before we are building software, right? So how do security experts now interplay or collaborate with engineers? Are they there in a team? Do you, like, for example, some of the engineering teams have like squads or packs, what they call, right? Where we have different roles and responsibilities and expertise in one, you know, autonomous cycle, where they can really do their thing independent of everybody else? Or do you say, well, there's like a security part of our company and that hops in from time to time or at certain, you know, steps or something like this?
So you know, the, your question to me comes down to, do you embed security into the product teams themselves, or do you have a separate product security function, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of reviews and approvals of from a security perspective? There are pluses and minuses to doing it both ways. You know, you and I share some Microsoft DNA, right, in our past careers, and Microsoft actually developed an interesting way to try and divide who needs a full security review with dedicated security personnel versus who can sort of have, you know, essentially a security champion embedded within the product team that can do, you know, an appropriate level of security testing, review, checking, running of tools, et cetera. And I think the way that Microsoft used to fork these projects was having developers at the start of developing either a feature or, you know, even a brand new product, going into internal tooling and essentially determining what the relative risks are for that component or that software. And if you do it based on this software or this component is going to be taking input from outside users or untrusted inputs, or it's going to be attached to the internet, or it has some other high value function, then perhaps those ones would benefit from a dedicated security review as opposed to being just trusting it to the security minded folks who live inside that product team.
Cool. And so one other area that I wanted to talk with you about is because you said reliability. And whenever I hear reliability, I think about data, right? And so data breaches are, you know, everywhere. And somehow I also feel organizations don't really take our data with a lot of, you know, they take it lightly, let's say, right? If it gets out, well, I'm sorry, you know, your credit card, your street address, everything that's private to you just leaved and is somewhere. And then we pretend it might not be happening to you, right? So it's only like a small percentage of, you know, our records, million of records. It's only like 30% of our records that went out. So it's probably not you. So every time I get an email, I'm like, oh, I think it's not me. So we are all a little bit more, you know, at ease again, and we forget about these data breaches. But what can we actually really do about these data breaches? Can we prevent them? Can we do something internally to really make sure the data is secured or, you know, is safe? Or should we outsource that to, you know, some services, for example, that store the data? What's your take on that here?
I think that, you know, the most common IT practices are what people are struggling with. But even as we've just seen with some of the targeted attacks that have been hitting the news this week, you know, you can do as many of the best practices as possible. And, you know, if there's an adversary who's determined, they are going to get to you, right? I think that we do struggle as an industry with nailing the basics. And it is often, breaches are often not due to a software vulnerability, but actually due to phishing, the human factor. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think there's a number of different technology things you can do, obviously encrypting your data at rest and in transit, limiting the number of people who have access to this data, limiting the APIs that have access to that data is another overlooked area, you know, that often gets abused and results in some of these breaches. But, you know, I think it's just a really broad, you know, broad topic. I for one, you know, think that we're not going to get, you know, one, you know, big umbrella answer that will stop data breaches. I think that, you know, we'll always have targeted attacks that end up being a big problem. And then, you know, for the majority of them, you know, still being because of phishing attacks that we see breaches. And in fact, the Verizon breach report, you know, used to be a great kind of publication, anti, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt publication, because they had data on breaches, and it was less than 1% of the breaches were typically due to a zero-day vulnerability. Most were either phishing. Next down from that are vulnerabilities that have been known and patched for a very, very long time. So mm-hmm. the organizations just hadn't applied the patches yet and the breach happened that way. So, I mean, every organization is going to be different as to what their answer and what their key takeaways are for, you know, a breach that happened to them or a breach that they could potentially learn from the outside.
Yeah, one. I actually watched a talk of you very recently at this conference called Friends of Europe. And before your talk, there was actually one governmental person talking. I don't know exactly who she was. I forgot, to be honest. But it was a very, very interesting topic to me because I've never heard of it. And this is that during COVID, there were a lot of attacks on, you know, hospitals, governments, and so on. Do you know about them and why is it happening? Why are people, you know, I understand this idea of being a hacker, being, you know, a researcher to do that. But why would we attack, for example, hospitals or, you know, in such a very delicate situation, do people want money or what do they get out of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the attacks du jour seem to be ransomware related. But I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, actually, some well-known ransomware groups said that they would not deliberately attack healthcare facilities. Not all criminals have that code of honor, though. And I think there was also a lot of unintentional targeting that occurred, which is always the case when you've got a very big internet and these attacking groups will scan, you know, big subsets of the internet, and wherever they find victims, they're not necessarily targeting the hospital, but they may get caught up in a broad untargeted attack looking for malware victims. So I think that's really where at least some of the initial infections were coming from. We did see some of the criminal groups say, we promise, you know, we're not going to lock up hospitals, et cetera. And then some who, you know, don't really care, you know, in particular, and also knowing that causing a disruption in a healthcare facility has a very high chance of a ransom in a ransomware situation being paid for to avoid loss of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I know that you are working with governments, you're working with military, not only with businesses. And this is something that I find really fascinating. And when I think about it, I imagine that it's extremely strict, right? That the military, very rigid. And it's almost a little bit frightening, but also I imagine that military systems are probably the most secure ones that you come by. Do they even need help from outside, from security experts? And in which way is it different to work with them than, for example, with, you know, an ordinary business?
Well, you know, in my work with the U.S. military over the years, they are moving towards embracing more of what private industry does, right? The whole initiative of Hack the Pentagon was basically one of the first initiatives coming out of a new program at the Pentagon called Defense Digital Service. And I think that, you know, the desire to evolve and work with private industry and follow private industry best practices is absolutely there. But I think it's a misunderstanding that, you know, military installations are going to be the most secure because there are a lot of different regulations and different rules about even how quickly they can deploy a patch, right? Mm. So, you know, if you think about it, availability from a military standpoint is probably going to take a lot higher priority than patching something that may or may not get exploited, right? If you are supporting a military mission, you are not going to, you know, necessarily do a downtime maintenance window to get all of those patches out. So does the military need help? Yes, absolutely, as all organizations do. And also something else to consider here is that we are at a global shortage of cybersecurity professionals filling open job roles that exist right now. I think when we get into the government space and military space, you run into issues of, you know, in the military, you're dealing with folks that are enlisted and trained or recruited and trained in how to do cybersecurity, cyber warfare, et cetera. In government, you are dealing with government pay scales not being anywhere near close to what a person could earn in cybersecurity in a career in private industry. So I think that there are a number of different factors that are involved in you know, securing military organizations, government organizations, and they're not necessarily all the same, or they're not necessarily straightforward with the same issues that we see in private industry. There are some overlaps, but there are different kinds of priorities and struggles.
Yeah, I totally see that. And also, I think if you are thinking about, you know, how many people there are in the government or in the military, and then, you know, compare that with the sheer amount of people and knowledge and brains and, you know, expertise that we have outside. If you can tap into that, it's obviously extremely valuable, right? Also different experience, different backgrounds. Yeah. So, Katie, I wanted to talk a little bit with you about your entrepreneurial journey, because I know Luther Security now is like 5 years old, something like this.
It's like 4.5 years, but yeah.
Yeah. And so how did that get started? Why did you start doing your own thing? And was it hard at the beginning?
It's, you know, it's hard and it's fun. It's both of those things at once. You know, I tend to be kind of a workaholic, and it's really funny because at Luta, I've managed to not exactly break that habit, but at least confine it to 32 hours a week. So, you know, in my entrepreneurial journey, I've discovered that actually working longer hours is not necessarily going to get me the same return as working more efficiently and trying to fit that in. But why did I start the company? Well, you know, there's a saying that entrepreneurs are insane, and they are insane in a very specific way, where they get irrationally upset about a problem that they are convinced that they can solve. And, you know, I think I've been irrationally upset at how poorly vulnerability disclosure has gone over the last like 20 plus years, that I, you know, I agreed when I was at Microsoft to work on ISO standards. Now a hacker working on international standards creation just seems like the torture that it really was, you know, but it was important to spend that decade of my life working on those standards, because, you know, it enabled us to shape a different way for companies and governments to interact with hackers. And one of my, you know, earliest goals from the first time I went to DEF CON back in 1999, DEF CON 7, as I watched my friends from Cult of the Dead Cow and throw, you know, USB throw out copies of, it wouldn't have been USB sticks, it would have been CDs of Back Orifice back then, which was their hacking tool, and realizing that, you know, in terms of our ability to contribute knowledge to the world, you know, it was pretty much limitless, but we had to figure out a way to have the world hear us and not dismiss us as, you know, a bunch of cyberpunks, basically. So I think that, you know, from my entrepreneurial journey, one, figuring out that I knew a better way for organizations to interact with security researchers and outside reporters of security bugs, but also, you know, a way that kind of blends the world that 25 years ago I would have been punk rock rebelling against, you know, the corporate and military world of computing, but find a way to blend, you know, my hacker mindset and my desire to change the world in, you know, in a bigger way than one bug at a time is really what drove me to start my company.
Yeah, it sounds very exciting. And I think if you have like this mission and this passion for something, I mean, it can only go in one direction. I think that's the good direction. So another area that I wanted to quickly touch on before we are wrapping this interview up is what advice would you give to people that want to become hackers, right? So what are the first steps? Is this something that you can learn on a non-traditional path? Can you go online and read about securities? Can you maybe, you know, go into some of those security challenges, maybe be in a team that, you know, have different expertise and you can learn from? Or do you think there is a specific, you know, way how you can become a hacker, and also a hacker in a very professional way, right? Where you can earn your living with it and, you know, positively contribute to our society.
Well, you know, when I had done some labor market research on the vulnerability economy and exploit market, I did it a few years back with MIT Sloan School as a visiting scholar. What we found is that hackers, their longevity of being sort of at the forefront of their profession, hacking, is about 7 years total. And the reason for that, you know, and I say this because you asked, how do you become a hacker, right? Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is you can become a hacker, but you have to think past, what are you going to do 7 years after that, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not a very long time. The reason it tends to sort of do this bell curve of, you know, at the peak of your hacking career, you know, it tends to be a 7-year span, is because technology changes. technology changes, it becomes more complex. You saw buffer overflows, you know, very easy to find and exploit. Now, if you find a buffer overflow, there may be a number of different mitigations in place where you were lucky to find it, but good luck to you. And it's a different skill set almost in trying to exploit it. So we see hackers sort of spanning their hacking career, part of their professional career, of about 7 years. So what I would say is, if you're thinking about taking a turn into hacking and have that be a chapter of your career, as it has been for mine, just think about what area are you the most interested in making an impact? You know, several years back, a lot of hackers started looking at medical devices. And the reason was because they wanted to make sure that, you know, as these things gained internet connectivity and functionality, which they had not had before, that, you know, we weren't exposing medical patients to something worse than having to install a software patch at an inconvenient time. We were concerned about human life. And so if you're interested in these types of things, you know, there's a number of different online forums that you can, you know, that you can start reading. There are capture the flag competitions, you know, that provide a safe learning environment where you're learning how to not just think like a hacker, but actually try and gain access, much like a red teamer would. And then there's a lot of different jobs that are hacking related and are absolutely essential to security, but don't require the hacker skill set per se. So I would encourage people who want to get a job in cybersecurity that don't just look to the hacker pathway. That happened to be my pathway, but perhaps it's because I was not as good a software developer as I should have been, right? And that breaking code was easier. So maybe that was why that's how I chose to contribute. So find your own path and be flexible with yourself, always keeping in mind that 7 years from whenever you've made it as a hacker, you may be desperately looking for something more stimulating or broader in terms of your scope and your ability to change the world.
Yeah, I really like, and it very resonates with what you said, because what I always find really tricky is those labelings, right? So whenever I have to label myself what I am, right? Am I a software engineer? Am I a researcher, right? Am I an entrepreneur? It's really hard for me. And I think maybe it's here, it's also a little bit more fluid, right? You could be security interested, right? You could work in a security related field. And I think it very much connects also to what we talked about at the beginning, where we have like these different teams and where are the roles that people can take on, right? Within a team or maybe in the security team. And so I think maybe this can also be fluid. Maybe first you are a software engineer and you are more interested or more passionate about the security aspects. And so, yeah, probably it's your passion, your interests, what you're learning, but also the opportunities that you get, right? It's not always, I mean, opportunities are not always handed out, especially for certain folks, right? It's sometimes you're waiting and you don't get the opportunity. And so this, I think, shapes also our path. And I like that you said, well, there are many, many roles that you can take on. And maybe you're going, you know, not the straight line to, you know, I'm here and I want to become a hacker, but it could be that you're going a little bit around. Yeah, Katie, I'm so happy that you have been on my podcast today. Is this something that you still want to say to my listeners, to my audience, that you want to, you know, leave them with a message somehow? Did you think it's important?
Well, I do think it's important to note that Luta Security is hiring developers. And I think that your audience is probably one of the best places I can make that request for, you know, for folks to check out lutasecurity.com/careers. And we'll be posting some developer roles up there shortly. But I think that overall, you know, the only other thing I would say is, you know, if folks are thinking about moving more into security as their full-time job, there is no limit, you know, and you can define your role and your job as, you know, as you like it. I think that that's something that people overlook about 20 years into the professionalization of the security career set, is that it's fixed in stone and that you have to go to school for it. I certainly didn't go to school for it. I didn't even go to school for computer science. I went for molecular biology and mathematics. So you can come from a different background entirely. And I think the future for us is getting people, it's a lot easier to train a developer on security and secure coding and secure architecture than it is to train a non-developer on how to properly architect and fix those things. So it's easier to go from a different technical area into technical areas around cybersecurity. So I would just say that, you know, folks should feel confident in that nobody has a map that is going to work for everybody else and that you have to draw your own.
Yeah, I really like that. I think these are wonderful closing words. So, Katie, thank you so much for being on my podcast today, for spending those minutes with us and sharing so much of your wisdom. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, before you go, let me tell you that my code review workshops are starting again. So if you want to transform your code review practices from bottleneck to superpower, check out my training at awesomecodereviews.com. So thank you for listening to another episode of the Soft Engineering Unlocked podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and I talk to you again in 2 weeks. Bye.